What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. Thank you so much for joining us. Wonderful to be here with you. Even though we're in times that are less than wonderful right now, a lot of terrible things going on, but we're going to, as usual, try to get through it together. As always, I encourage you to please like the stream, give it a thumbs up, subscribe if you haven't already subscribed, press subscribe and then the bell. Also, please do make sure if you can become Patreon supporters. And if you become Patreon supporters, you have access to great extra content, including pretty good live show, if I do say so myself, that we did with Abby Martin and Rania Kallik 2 weeks ago by now. So much has happened since then, obviously. We talked a lot about Nasrella, and then, of course, he was killed, which was terrible. And I'm just going to start off with the show. But again, you can become members at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And we are so excited to be bringing on Sam Husseini, who is an independent journalist who writes at husseini.substack.com. He's also written for a variety of publications, including Counterpunch, The Nation, The Washington Post. And he's written extensively about Palestine and international law. And he also regularly attends the State Department briefings and asks tough questions and doesn't always get called on because of that. And he's the founder of VotePact.org, which encourages left-right cooperation to undermine the establishment duopoly. He's also a visual artist, and you'll see some of his art behind him. So welcome, Sam.
Great to be with you. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you. Wanted to ask you, first of all, I mean, this is in such an insane moment, and there's so much to talk about, and it's overwhelming to even figure out where to start. The news is moving so quickly. But I guess, can you situate us where we are right now when it comes to a war in the Middle East and explain how we got here and what's next?
Well,
really easy questions, right?
Yeah. Israel is a long-term settler colonial project, and they got a nice, juicy pretext to do what much of the Israeli establishment wanted to do, which is to devastate Gaza even more than they have every couple of years in the past. And we have this sort of standoff with everybody sort of caught between some impulse to do something to stop it and the fear of not of doing anything to stop it, or else they'll get clobbered themselves. So we saw that very vividly in terms of Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is an armed resistance group, but is also a political party in Lebanon, which has been maliciously, smeared as simply a terrorist group by the U.S. and Israeli establishments. And this Nasrallah, their very charismatic leader, probably the most, you could almost call him a populist voice, the most prominent populist voice. And well, you said you had a show on him.
But so, not everyone was there. Feel free to elaborate on him. Yeah.
It's probably the most compelling voice critiquing U.S. and Israeli policy in the Middle East, as well as, and he fundamentally drove Hezbollah as a whole, drove Israel out of Lebanon in 2000 and then basically drove them out again in 2006. So,
and also, as we saw, just one interesting thing, I we did do a clip of this. I can't remember if it's included. I think it is. But he distinguished between, Zionism and Jews, which is something a lot of critics of Zionism does. But it's just interesting because, you know, Hezbollah is framed as anti-Semitic so frequently. So that was an interesting thing. Yeah.
Very much so. And I'm sure that he adopted that stance very early on. But it's fairly commonplace now among Islamic movements. I mean, Hamas changed their charter several years ago to that effect and so on. The latest, of course, is that Iran has retaliated against Israel. There was sort of a coordinated pseudo-retaliation back in April that might have been more performative than anything else. It's not clear. This seems to be more substantial than that and less performative, but it's not totally clear. I recently saw some reports that Dimona was one of the things hit, and they also targeted Mossad headquarters. They seem to be attempting to target what are all too legitimate military targets. I mean, I'm not a militarist at all, but they're not, aiming for schools here and such, unlike Israel. And Dimona is particularly important, of course, because that is the site of Israel's nuclear weapons capacity, which it and the United States refuse to acknowledge. So they are, I think, effectively trying to put that front and center. I should add, because I was at the UN last week, Iran, about, 48 hours ago, maybe 72 hours ago, asked for another urgent meeting of the UN Security Council. And as far as I can tell, they got pretty much blown off by the Security Council. So, and they put out a statement just a couple of hours ago saying that they were, acting with regards to their Article 51 rights under the UN Charter of Self-Defense, and that because Israel had repeatedly struck Iran, they assassinated Haniyeh, the political leader of Hamas in Tehran, and obviously other provocations, to put it politely, by Israel. So that's the best I can do for a thumbnail.
Could you tell us about your own family's history in this region? I know your family is Palestinian.
Sure. My dad was born in the Galilee, in Tiberias. He was driven out in 1948. He was 16 years old at the time, along with hundreds of thousands of other Palestinians. He was initially driven out to southern Lebanon, but he had a relative in Jordan, ended up in Jordan, in Zerqa, which, at the time was nothing. There was an army base, I think, there was the only thing there. And they started a refugee camp there, and it eventually became a city. But it started as just a refugee camp in 1948, and that's where he grew up. My mom is Jordanian, from Jordan, from Adaba. They're both, he's Catholic, she's Orthodox Christian. I've gone several times to Palestine, sometimes with him in Tiberias, the West Bank, and Gaza.
Do you still have family there?
Distant, barely in touch with. Most of my family's in Jordan. My more immediate cousins are in Amman.
Well, and I'm sorry, I know that your father passed away. You've written about that before. Mm-hmm. He was able to go back.
Yeah. I mean,
to return.
Yeah. I mean, when he was facing his death, he ended up being buried in a grave. There are very limited graves in the Christian cemetery in Jordan, and he couldn't be buried next to his mother. His mother died in Jordan as well. The family was dispersed and broken up after 1948. His father, it happened in the summer, and he was visiting other relatives in a nearby village called Eilamoun, which was ethnically cleansed. His father and his youngest brother were able to remain in what is now Israel, but they both died, and therefore Israel was able to confiscate all of their property. And one of the times when I went back with my dad, to Palestine. We saw a lawyer in Nazareth, he looked up all the records, and it, you know, had in English his father's name, Yusuf Husseini, you know, Joseph, basically scratched out, and in Hebrew, what Arabs call Hintish Bintish, which is a quasi government entity that is, you know, is designed to allocate land for the use of Jewish people exclusively. So that's how their property holdings were handled.
I'm sorry about everything that you and your family and all people from Palestine are going through. And I can't believe that our government is doing this. I mean, I guess I can. And it's disgusting that our tax dollars are going to this. But speaking of the things that our tax dollars are going to, here is the Israeli ambassador, Danny Dayan, speaking at the UN, and you question him about Israel's posture when it comes to Lebanon and Hezbollah.
So this is just before the Nasrallah assassination, like the day or two before.
Our position regarding Lebanon has always been very clear. We would prefer a diplomatic solution. We are entirely focused on achieving our objectives, which in the north is the return of our displaced citizens who have become refugees in their own country, back to their homes, back to their schools, back to their families. The suffering is always on our mind. If diplomacy fails to return our residents to their homes, then we will use all means at our disposal in accordance with international law to achieve our aims. And we will continue to target the terrorists. But all of this can stop immediately once Hezbollah will stop firing missiles and rockets into our civilian communities. There will be no cycle of violence in the region.
Hezbollah says they'll stop if you do a ceasefire in Gaza. So if you really care about the people in the north, why don't you do that?
The linkage that Iran decided to do between Hezbollah and Hamas, holding the people of Lebanon hostage, that's something which I'm not familiar with. How can you do that?
So everyone should just... You asked me a question.
I'm answering your question.
You asked me a question. The world should just step aside as you do all this carnage.
I'm not here to
The world should just step aside as you commit genocide.
I'm not here to listen to your opinion.
You asked me a question.
You ask a question, you get an answer. The linkage that the Iranian regime did between Hezbollah and Hamas, holding the Lebanese people hostage, that's not done. You don't start a war with Israel just because you want to show sympathy for the atrocities of Hamas.
You told the Hague to go to hell.
The Prime Minister of Lebanon. Yes.
So, okay, let's lots to unpack there. First of all, that's so moving at the beginning where he talks about how much he cares about civilians. But what's your response? If you could have kept going on with him, what would you like to have said to him?
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a very unlevel playing field. You know, he's at a podium, I'm being elbowed by other reporters and so on. I don't mean to take on every false thing that he says there or implicitous thing that he says there.
Because you didn't have all day.
The crux of it is that they are saying that they want to be able to slaughter people in Gaza without anybody doing anything to stop them. From Hezbollah's and from Yemen's point of view, that they're in effect, quite arguably saying we're implementing international law here. They don't quite put it in those terms, but implicitly, the international community has called for a ceasefire, has recently passed a General Assembly resolution. Telling Israel to withdraw from occupied territory and immediately and so on and so forth. And Israel just shrugs it off. It tells The Hague, it tells anybody and everybody to, go jump in a lake. So in effect, Hezbollah and Yemen are saying, you better do this. And Hezbollah was very clear in their statements, saying we will stop if you stop wrecking havoc in Gaza. We will stop. We will allow Israelis to return to the north and so on. So Israel isn't concerned about people in the north. They want what they are asserting is their right to slaughter people in Gaza. And one sort of weird effect of the threat of a quote-unquote wider war vis-a-vis Lebanon or vis-a-vis Iran is it almost takes the, you know, the focus off of Gaza, so that right. like one crime is a distraction from the last crime, and it shouldn't be the case. They should be, you know, a cumulative indictment, if anything.
Right. You know, something that's so fascinating is the way, and we're going to talk about this more with Norman Solomon also, who's our guest during the second half of this show, who does really excellent media criticism. But what's fascinating is that there is absolutely no consistency when it comes to the way the Western media and political elites judge the actions of Israel and Lebanon. So everything that Israel does is self-defense. It's somehow supporting the rules-based order. Everything that Hezbollah does is terrorism. Everything that Iran does is terrorism. There's never any discussion of the, you know, civilians killed when you're talking about terrorism. That's kind of irrelevant. It's not about the number of civilians killed. That's not what determines whether it's terrorism. What determines whether it's terrorism is whether or not the government or the country doing it or the people doing it are the adversaries of the United States. And I guess this is naive, but I was a little bit surprised by how much joy the West was sharing in its reaction to the killing of Nasrallah.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, this is, you know, the U.S. has this, you know, we designate who's a terrorist thing, and they put Hezbollah on the list, you know, and it's just, there's no adjudication process or anything like that. It's just, you know, the State Department draws up a list and they decide who it gets proclaimed as a terrorist, and the media just regurgitate that ad nauseum. So, I mean, there have been some decent reports, sometimes very old ones. Somebody, Decensored News, I think, clipped an old 60 Minutes thing where they actually sat down with Nasrallah and talked to them and, you know, talked about the complexity of the organization and so on. And there have been times when Hezbollah was positively depicted. I remember that, you know, in 2006, like the Daily Show, like, was, you know, impressed that they were able to clean up the mess right. after Israel bombed the crap out of Lebanon. But in times like this, the media, establishment media, predictably kick in and just dredge up the same old, caricatures rather than, you know, talking about it in the political and context in terms of what's going on in Gaza.
Right. I want to share another interaction that you had with a powerful person. You also questioned the French foreign minister, Jean-Noël Barrot, at the UN. And let's take a look at this clip.
So you have been working with the Americans on that proposal. Can you just...
Sorry, and just to explain, this is not you at the beginning. So someone else, a reporter is asking Barrot a question, then you're going to respond.
So you have been working with the Americans on that proposal. Can you just give us a bit details about this? Is it ready? Are you getting close for
agreement? On both sides, you will get the details when it becomes public. Vous aurez les détails quand il sera public.
Isn't this a consequence of the failure of the Security Council to properly implement the orders of the ICJ of May? You and most of the rest of the Security Council voted for a U.S. resolution that falsely claimed that Israel agreed to a ceasefire resolution. Didn't that, in effect, give Israel a green light for further aggression?
Non, les résolutions du Conseil de sécurité sont la base de la plateforme que nous sommes.
So as Sam points out in the subtitles, or whoever subtitled this points out, he's answering in French. He's entirely fluent in English. And then we're going to go back to his, we're going to share what his response is shortly. But first, let's just watch this back and forth.
Sur la base du, sur, que nous sommes en train d'élaborer avec nos partenaires américains. Et je crois qu'au contraire, il était très utile de convoquer cette réunion urgente du Conseil de sécurité qui a permis à chacun de s'exprimer et évidemment à la communauté internationale d'appeler à un cessez-le-feu le plus rapidement possible.
We don't have automatic translation here. Could you please give an English response? You're literally speaking a different language. I understand, but we don't have translation.
Were they actually telling you there that he was speaking in French or that he was French? What were they trying to clarify when you say I understood?
I think they were trying to clarify that it's legitimate that he speaks in French. It's an official language. And in fairness, his opening remarks were in French. But when typically questioned in English, he answers in English, as we saw. But he chose not to do that because his response was a total non sequitur.
Well, let me give you his response so people can get a sense of how seriously he answered this question. The resolutions of the Security Council are the basis of the platform we are developing with our American partners. And I believe that, on the contrary, it was very useful to convene this emergency meeting of the Security Council, which obviously enabled everyone to express their views and for the international community to call for a ceasefire as soon as possible. Okay, so what's
That's just Diplo gibberish. That just saying we're having UN Security Council meeting and we all get to say what we want to say at the UN Security Council meeting. Big whoop. What the point that I was making, and what I mean, people might have been familiar with the genocide case brought forth by South Africa against Israel. I had done a lot of work pushing for a country to do that throughout 2023, and then South Africa finally did. The court issued a series of orders as South Africa kept going back to the court, very appropriately, and it is actually overdue. Somebody should keep doing that to ask for additional provisional measures. And they asked for provisional measures in May, and the court responded even more directly than they had before. They outright said Israel must stop its invasion of Rafah on May 24th. Which the court stipulated began on May 7th. Algeria put forward a resolution for the Security Council to vote on. The U.S. scuttled it and then eventually put forward its own resolution after Joe Biden made his phony, baloney propaganda statement that Israel has agreed to a ceasefire. Why the hell is Joe Biden making a statement about Israel agreeing to anything? And then they got the Security Council to pass the U.S. resolution, which made no reference to the orders of the International Court of Justice on June 10th. And Joe Biden, every time he talks about Gaza, brags about this appropriately. It was a substantial accomplishment to sabotage international law. So during the debate with Trump, I know it didn't go well for Biden. I think that was arranged, but that's a subject for another day. He bragged about it. Anytime that Joe Biden gets a chance, this is his main talking point. The Security Council gave their blessings for their so-called ceasefire process. So they effectively hijacked the language of the peace movement. And I think the peace movement could have done a lot better in terms of asserting itself to see that this was a phony attempt to subvert international law. You mentioned earlier, Katie, the rules-based order. I think that's another way of subverting international law, right? The U.S. talks about a rules-based order. What does that mean? They get to implement whatever rule seems useful to them at any particular time. So if they want to invade Afghanistan, they talk about feminism. They invoke rules around that. If they want to do this, then they'll invoke rules around that. So they get to decide which rules gets invoked at what point. And this is part of how they manipulate things. So that my challenge to the French and to others who pretend to care is, why have you not implemented the orders of the International Court of Justice? Now, the most recent thing that happened was that the General Assembly passed a large resolution by an overwhelming majority, like 140-something countries, implementing much of the UN Security Council, much of the International Court of Justice rulings regarding Israel and Palestine. But it doesn't, it has some teeth. It talks about some level of sanctions, but it seems to be, targeting, settlement activity and so on, which is perfectly appropriate, but it's not broad-ranging sanctions with real teeth, like the General Assembly did with respect to South Africa, for example. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. I think that this is a main lever for people, especially activists in New York. I spent a week in New York, and the whole area was cornered off while I was there, because it was, these high profile meetings. But typically the U.S. mission to the UN right across the street from the main UN building is a huge, juicy target for real protests, especially with activists and students not being welcome on their own campuses. They can literally take the world stage by taking their grievances directly to the U.S. mission to the UN. And that would change the dynamics because the other missions can say, look, you can't even keep your own people on the reservation. You know, who are you to be bossing us around at the Security Council when you got, you know, whatever it is, dozens of kids, hundreds of people in front of the U.S. mission on a regular basis. So I think that that is a major thing that people can do if they're in New York, especially.
You quote tweeted a video of Iranian missiles falling near the Israeli Dimona nuclear reactor. And you wrote, Dimona, it has been said, is the actual place of Israel's third temple. It has put its faith in nuclear weapons arsenal. So can you, and here we have those videos. Okay, and then can you elaborate on the calling it its third temple?
There's a book by that title, The Third Temple, by a fellow named Mark Gaffney. I think Chomsky might have written the prefix for it or written a blurb for it. That's how I picked it up. I saw it in a bookstore or something. I was like, you know, I was getting into Chomsky many years ago and curious about Israel's nuclear capacity. And he basically, you know, branded it as, you know, they're not focusing so much on Jerusalem. They're focusing on nuclear weapons. And that's ultimately their dominance. I hear John Mersheimer talking a lot about how Israel doesn't have escalatory dominance. I think it does. I think he somehow thinks that use of nuclear weapons is unthinkable, and I don't think it is. I think everyone is very mindful that Israel has nuclear weapons and can therefore blow the crap out of anybody and potentially everybody. You know, I mean, ultimately, they can do the Samson option, which would be to dust Moscow, which would presumably result in a Russian retaliation on the United States. So it would not just simply slaughter, you know, Arabs and Muslims, but everybody. And the U.S. refuses to acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons. I've made a point of asking the State Department, various senators, including members of the so-called squad, none of them will forthrightly acknowledge that Israel has a nuclear weapons arsenal, which tells me that they are all, you know, just being fed what to say from the State Department. You know, push comes to shove, they can pose and say whatever they want to say. But I did a piece on this that, you know, went through and I emailed all of the major critics of Israel in Congress. You know, what do you say about this? And, you know, didn't get a single positive response. So, you know, that there is clearly an agenda at play here. And I think it needs to be forcefully, faced by the international community and by the U.S. public. And it has a huge history that goes way back. I mean, Ben Gurion jerked around JFK, because JFK was insisting on inspections. He kept coming up with reasons to stall him. And then finally JFK said, you know, we're going to have to reassess our relationship. And then JFK was assassinated. Johnson just let it go. And then they developed this understanding of, you know, nobody says a word about it, but we winky, 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 winky. We know that you got nuclear weapons. Desmond Tutu's last article was on this very subject. As Biden was coming into office, Desmond Tutu wrote an article imploring Biden to break this spell of not acknowledging Israel's nuclear weapons capacity, which is a threat to humanity, which violates international, which violates U.S. law. U.S. isn't supposed to be giving money to nuclear proliferators, which Israel obviously is.
Yeah, it's really interesting because people are very concerned about Iran getting nuclear weapons. Of course, the same people who are concerned about that were cheering on Trump ruining the deal the Iran nuclear deal and are fine with Biden following in Trump's footsteps instead of Obama's. But yet right. there's no fear of Israel nuclear weapons. I mean, there's no discussion of it, the fact that they have them. But I mean, it's they're so unhinged. I mean, look at what they're doing right now. Why aren't people afraid of that when Iran uses so much restraint compared to Israel? It's not remotely comparable.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. I mean, Israel literally gets away with murder day in, day out. And it's the biases of the U.S. establishment and of the adjacent media and increasingly the big tech platforms. And so on. And you need to find creative ways of getting around that.
I want to mention some things that I saw in the comments. So a lot of people want to know more about the Samson option. And then someone said something. There's always a lot of controversy when it comes to JFK and how anti-war he was or how critical of this he was. There was someone pushing back on whoever wrote that. Write it again if you want. Someone pushing back on something that you said about JFK, and I wanted you to respond to it because there's kind of, I feel like there are two schools of thought when it comes to JFK. Some people think he was actually really a threat to the war machine, and some people think he wasn't.
Well, I think that he was in this regard. I wrote a piece about this about a year ago. For many years, I sort of took Chomsky at face value of saying that JFK wasn't going to be different than the rest of the establishment. But what was remarkable to me was finding out that, and I had followed Israel's nuclear capacity and questioned politicians about it, but I didn't know that JFK had objected so strenuously until just a couple of years ago. And I started looking at that and I found a substantial case that no, he was really pushing back on this. And simultaneously, RFK was looking at making AIPAC a foreign agent, Israel. He was actually contacted, I think, initially by the American Council on Judaism or something like that, anti-Zionist Jews were initially the ones who brought to his attention that the American Zionist Council was setting up AIPAC and he needs to do something about this. And he was very favorably inclined to do so. Similarly, after JFK was assassinated, Johnson dropped that as well.
And then the Samson option, can you just elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, that's been written about extensively by Chomsky and by Cy Hirsch about the possibility of a nuclear doctrine from Israel, that it would threaten everybody if it felt that it was endangered or its vital interests or whatever were endangered. I mean, it's sort of similar to the Hannibal Directive, right?
What do you mean? That doesn't exist. You're so ignorant. How could you say that? Don't you know anything?
Right.
Yeah, that's the refrain you get when you bring up the Hannibal Doctrine, right? Which is basically you'd rather kill your own hostages than let them be taken away because you don't want to negotiate. Yeah. And we saw everyone who said that there was a Hannibal Directive used on October 7th was called a conspiracy theorist. And now Israeli media is acknowledging that there was actually a mass Hannibal.
Right. And I did ask about it at the State Department at one point, and they were like, we have nothing about that alleged directive or something like right. Matt Miller basically denied that it existed. And it's always the light to force him to lie directly.
Right. You know, what's interesting is Hannibal, the actual case of Hannibal, like the actual person, that was a case of suicide, mass suicide. But what Israel's doing is not suicide. It's the opposite. It's homicide.
It's homicide of its own citizens. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mass homicide. Yeah. Wanted to ask you finally about VOPACT, what VOPACT is, how you thought of it and what you think it could do, especially because tonight is, of course, the night of the vice presidential debates.
VOPACT is a super strategic way of voting so that instead of one person self-loathingly voting for Harris and another self-loathingly voting for Trump, they pair up and both vote for the non-genocidal candidates of their choice so that you're voting for something that you believe in, but you're not doing it in a way that would help the candidate that you hate the most. So this is a way, for example, for left liberal person to find a right-leaning person in their life, and instead of voting for Harris because they feel like they must stop Trump at all costs, that they pair up with a person who might vote for Trump, and both vote for whatever it is, Green Party or Libertarian, or they can vote for the same candidate, they can vote for other candidates, whatever they actually, whatever their actual preference is. It's a strategy that takes some work. What's the old Bob Marley quote? When the power of love exceeds the love of power, we'll know peace. This is a way for anyone and everyone to deal a serious blow to the system. Now, if you're already planning on voting for a non-genocidal candidate, A, congratulations. But B, your role in this could be pivotal because you can start pairing people up. Especially people who start pestering you about why you're voting for a candidate that has no chance of winning. And then you tell them, why are you voting for a genocidal candidate? And they'll say, because the other guy is worse. Now, and you'll say, well, you can pair up with somebody else on the other side. And this could, at least theoretically, snowball. And unlike other voting strategies, it is not an attempt to lessen the damage of third parties. It literally opens the door to actual victory for third party candidates. Now, I don't know if the candidates that we've got in the field right now are up to it, they could be. It's a great, I think, organizing technique for people to use over the next several weeks, because elections are what times when that eviscerates people's brains, right? They got to, people who were displaying some semblance of independent thought, a lot of them go back to their partisan boxes as an election approaches, and this is a way of breaking out of that. I actually thought about this years and years ago, and I've written about it periodically, and I still haven't forgiven Ralph Nader for not embracing it in 2000. But I literally thought of it when I was walking down a hill with my dad, and we were dead tired. I think we went and played Frisbee or something, and we leaned on each other as we walked down the hill. And that's actually the origin of how I, thought of, by leaning on something else, you actually lessen the weight of it. From that, I came up with that idea.
So you would have to find, right? So you basically, this is to avoid giving the voting for Trump if you're a leftist, right? Or I guess people on the right are accused of maybe voting for Harris if they don't vote for Trump. But so the idea is, you vote for the person, let's just say, most people watching the show like Jill Stein. So you vote for Jill Stein, but you're not voting for Trump because you are canceling out a would-be Trump voter's vote, right? But you should both be in a swing state, right, for this to work?
Well, it works best if the people are in the same state. And I emphasize people turning to people in their life. And I'm not talking about, there's always going to be 1% that votes for, a Jill Stein, right? The problem is that she appears far more marginal than she is because of the fear factor, right? Her poll numbers, I think, undermine the level of support that her policies have. So this is kind of a way that would grow it out so that people who are on the fence or nervous or whatever would embrace voting for a Jill Stein or some other candidate. And the would-be Trump voter can vote for the Libertarian or Constitution or whatever, or conceivably a left-wing candidate if they have very good reasons for voting for Trump because they think he's standing up for the working person, whatever. I've generally talked about people doing it for somebody in their own lives, but somebody has actually set up a website called breaktheduopoly.com, which actually pairs people up. And it pairs people up in the same state. So if you're, in Pennsylvania or whatever state you're in, you can go there, New York, you can go there and find your mirror image.
Yeah. Although in New York, it doesn't really matter because it's a safe state. But yeah.
I know, but, you know, I mean, there's a limited logic of that, right? Because, I agree with you, but, you know, if more and more people started voting for Jill Stein, then it wouldn't be a safe state for long. Right. So I think people sense that. I think people, you know, don't buy into the safe state strategy totally because they know that there's a limited, you know, it's a limited, it's got a cap on it.
Yeah. Well, I remember people trying to do that with Nader. People in wanted to, if they lived in a swing state, they wanted to vote for Dem, but they would have a friend in a safe state vote for Nader. That was the idea.
And this is part of the reason that people have not been able to comprehend Vote Pact at times, because they confuse it with this, you know, vote crater, swapping thing. That is
someone
not
wrote, even, this idea needs a name so it can spread.
Well, Vote Pact. But I'm happy if somebody comes up with a better name. Another guy came up with it independently and called it Vote Buddy.
Oh yeah, Vote Buddy. Yeah.
Okay.
Lean vote lean. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Lean into vote. I don't know.
You know, somebody did rebrand this as the Balanced Rebellion, a group that was backing Gary Johnson in 2016, and they actually set up a very slick webpage and had a very witty video with the dead Abe Lincoln, and got like 30 something million views on Facebook. People don't remember this. Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate in 2016, which he was not a very attractive candidate in some ways, he was actually the most successful third party run since Perot. He outdid Nader.
Well,
I think in part because of the Balanced Rebellion thing.
Well, libertarians tend to have a lot of money. So wanted to ask you final question. Do you think that there is a substantive difference between a Trump president and a Harris president when it comes to Palestine?
I don't know. I don't know what their actual policies are going to be. It's possible that Trump could be worse. I know that most people on the left scoff at that because so far we have not seen Israel forcibly displace Palestinians from Gaza and the West Bank. It's not inconceivable to me that Trump could greenlight that and could try to pay off Sisi in Egypt to do that. But it's also not inconceivable that the Democrats could do that after the election, right? I think that the establishment instrumentalizes every political figure. Carter, in the name of peace, did Camp David, which took Egypt out of the equation, which gave Israel dominance. I've written critically about Trump, I could imagine a version of America First that compelled corporations to begin their meetings, their board meetings, with a pledge of allegiance to the flag. Now that would be a far more compelling version of America First than anything else that I've seen come out of the establishment. But the system takes whatever president is coming in and pressures them to mold to its own particular agenda in a way that fits their way of being. I view them, all presidents in my lifetime, as having been in effect instruments of the establishment. And Vote Pact, I think, is a very creative way of facing that down by uniting people. Because in spite of all the rhetoric and all the name calling and everything, the establishment colludes. The Democrat, they're always cutting their deals. You know, Schumer and the Republicans in Congress and whoever, they're always cutting their deals together to benefit Warren Wall Street.
A great book on that is Listen Liberal by Thomas Frank.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
I just like the book. Yeah. Well, Sam, thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. Please do come back on because we have so much more to talk about. We'll have you back on soon.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Bye. Okay, that was Sam Husseini. That was great. Everyone give this a thumbs up. Give this a like if you haven't already. And we are going to keep the show moving. We're bringing on the next guest. We're so excited to bring him back onto the show. We are bringing on Norman Solomon, who is Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and National Director of RootsAction.org. His latest book is War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. In a starred review, Kirkus Reviews called the book a powerful, necessary indictment of efforts to disguise the human toll of American foreign policy. The paperback edition of War Made Invisible was published this fall with a 30-page afterword about the Gaza war. And he is a prolific journalist, media critic, and activist. So welcome, Norman.
Hey, thanks a lot, Katie.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
So I wanted to start off by asking you some questions about what has changed since you wrote War Made Invisible, what you had to add to this about Gaza, and how it changed, if it did at all, the kind of overall thesis of the book.
Well, the main thesis when the book came out a little over a year ago had to do with the way in which in this century we went from, you know, boots on the ground, as the saying goes, hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And although the coverage was hiding the human realities of the war, at least it was on front pages and evening news, and people were scrolling. They would see video of troops heading out and bombers and then the troops coming home. But slowly and steadily in this century, it changed where the wars were not so obvious to the U.S. public, and they were more and more being fought from the air. And it was the long-range Raytheons and Boeings and other corporations that were really finding new ways to make huge profits. And so the War Made Invisible title has to do with the way in which the realities of war more and more on the superficial level and also on the cognitive and emotional levels as well, were really fading into the, you might say, to mix metaphors, the walls of the echo chamber. We didn't see it. We didn't hear it. It was very much euphemized. So after the book came out, and then a few months later, the war on Gaza began, I wanted to write an afterword for the paperback that I knew was coming out this fall. And I thought about, now, what is the relevance of the through line of the book, the title and the subtitle? And I came up with, as I really pondered this, that the invisibility of war, in this case, financed and enabled by the U.S. government, really was a replica of the way in which the U.S. media covered and didn't cover what the U.S. had been doing earlier in the century in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and elsewhere that we got even less attention to. And then the subtitle, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And Katie, I think now this is even much more obvious than it was 6 months ago or almost 12 months ago. And that is that the U.S. war machine and the Israeli military are essentially the same. They're not identical. They have different command structures. But when it comes down to their functions, the way in which they operate in the Middle East, and the way in which they, to stretch the word, their ethical precepts are so degraded and so, from a public relations standpoint, so Orwellian that there's tremendous continuity. And I sort of close this particular thought by mentioning that the day after October 7th, both the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations outside of a Security Council meeting in New York and the Israeli ambassador to the United States speaking on the PBS weekend show, both used the same phrase. They said, "This is our 9/11. Obviously not a coincidence. They're both putting that line out. And on a surface basis, as I say in the book, that could sort of make sense to people. Oh, yeah, you know, there was this terrible crime committed on October 7th, and it was a terrible crime. And so many Israelis died as a result of what Hamas had done. But what was not talked about on October 8th and isn't being talked about today in the mass media or Congress is that the response from the United States to 9/11 and the response to October 7th by the Israeli government is mass murder. And so you look at the numbers and you try to connect with the humanity of people who have been slaughtered and still are being slaughtered by, in this case, the Israeli government, and the role of the U.S. news media and what passes for political discourse along Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington is to make them invisible. And this is a theme that was in the initial edition of War Made Invisible, and that I elaborate on in terms of the context for the terrible war ongoing as we speak in Gaza. And that is that there are two tiers of grief, two levels of grief, that we are overtly and insidiously encouraged to connect with and not connect with. So to sort of sum up, there are people on this planet who U.S. mass media and the U.S. government tell us subtly and not so subtly their lives really matter. American troops, Ukrainians who are being killed by an official enemy of Washington, their lives really matter. And I have no quarrel whatsoever with that empathy. But then there are people whose lives at the other tier of grief who are discounted, who are, without it being so overtly said, treated overall, with rare exceptions in the news media, as subhuman. And this is where we get into a fascistic kind of politics that certainly is overt from the Israeli government and is being actively enabled by the U.S. government.
Yeah, it's really interesting because we're going to get to that discrepancy in a second. And of course, it makes me think of, and you refer to this as well frequently, Chomsky's worthy victims and unworthy victims. But what's right. fascinating about this invisibility issue is, and someone else was talking about this, about actually, I don't know if you saw the movie Zone of Interest, which is about, yes. right, so it's about, you know, a commandant living next to Auschwitz and how normalized everything is. And there's a lot of talk, of course, about Arendt's concept of the banality of evil. But as a friend pointed out, after we saw that film, it's actually kind of the opposite in the case of Israel, not in the United States' representation of the Israeli assault, but in Israel's representation of it, because there's actually a celebration of evil, like a glee of evil. You see these live streams of people celebrating. They don't even try to hide it, right? They wear women's lingerie. They literally gang rape someone on video. That's Day Tayman. They celebrate when they put on people's clothes. They celebrate when they take over their homes. But there, of course, is an attempt to cover up what's happening here. So the Israeli government, you know, says one thing when it's speaking to Israelis and then another thing when it's speaking to a Western audience. But in terms of the double standard that you just referred to, you actually, I'm going to quote something that is in your book. It's from the extra chapter, and you refer to an Intercept analysis from The Intercept. So you say, in-depth content analysis by The Intercept found that coverage of the war's first 6 weeks by the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times showed a consistent bias against Palestinians. Those highly influential news outlets, quote, disproportionately emphasized Israeli deaths in the conflict and used emotive language to describe the killings of Israelis, but not Palestinians, end quote. For example, quote, the term slaughter was used by editors and reporters to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 60-1, and massacre was used to describe the killings of Israelis versus Palestinians 125-2. Horrific was used to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 36-4. And we see that right now, to this day, we see that media bias and that whitewashing and obfuscation of Israel's crimes. In fact, a New York Times article from today says that Israel sends troops into southern Lebanon, not that Israel invades southern Lebanon. So can you talk more about the way the media is whitewashing, not just what's happening in Gaza, but how it's applying to what's happening now in Lebanon?
The language is really crucial. You use the term normalization, which I think is very important for us to keep circling back to as we analyze what's happening. In the U.S., it's a normalization of Orwellianisms that become so routine that we don't, or we're encouraged not to give it a second thought. In terms of the Israeli attack on Lebanon, it's classic. Israel is retaliating. And while there is some mention that Iran says they're retaliating against Israeli attacks, that is at arm's length in terms of the language. And when we get to the bombing, for instance, of hospitals, and this is where in the book I get into comparing, say, and certainly a terrible Russian war on Ukraine, but quite correctly, properly, there has been huge amounts of empathetic coverage in U.S. media about how Russia has bombed hospitals in Ukraine. And then you compare it to the U.S. coverage of Israel's bombing of health centers, ambulances now in Lebanon, as well as classically in Gaza. The tonality is really different, with some exceptions. And as I say in the book, the essence of propaganda is repetition. It's the code words, the catchphrases, what's put in, what's left out, time and again. So that's where the stats that I cited that The Intercept came up with in its study is so important. An example, you know, when you step back a little bit, okay, this is the first 6 weeks after October 7th, and these most were told highest quality of U.S. media outlets, LA Times, Washington Post, New York Times, they use in their narrative, their reporting, the word slaughter 60 times, applying it to what was done to Israelis. And they use it once, the same word, to what's being done to people in Gaza. And it's even worse because in that period of time, many more people were being killed, civilians were being killed in Gaza. And we know, the United Nations has been very clear about this, that the large majority of people killed, courtesy of U.S. taxpayers by the Israeli military, have been children and women. And something that I have written about and allude to indirectly in the book is that people may remember in Uvalde, Texas, when there was the killing at a public school. And there was some media coverage. The young man who slaughtered those people at the school had bought the gun and ammunition at a gun shop. And the question came up, well, what about the gun shop that sold this, what turned out to be lethal materiel? And the owner of the gun shop did not know what the sold weaponry would be used for. Joe Biden knows and has known for 51 months what the weapons that the U.S. was providing to Israel would be used for and was being used for. And the same goes for people in Congress. And I give the example in the book, which at the time sort of blew my mind, and I thought it was important to put in the afterword of War Made Invisible, because again, it's another layer of, it's another permutation of the inhumane, desensitized, spiritually deadening invisibility that is conferred upon what the United States government does in our names with our tax dollars. We had Chris Van Hollen, who one of the very few senators from Maryland who went to Gaza, who went to the border. This was in February of this year. And he saw huge quantities of trucks laden with food and water and medicine, and they were blocked at the border by the Israeli military. And on the other side of the border in Gaza, people were suffering and wasting away, and some of them starving. So Van Hollen goes on the floor of the United States Senate, and he says that what the Israeli government was doing, what the leaders of the Israeli government were doing, was a war crime, and the leaders of the Israeli government are war criminals. A few hours later, that same Senator Van Hollen voted in favor of $14 billion with a B dollars worth of weapons for Israel. So, you know, we think like it's like a newspeak or doublethink in Orwell's book 1984, where a certain fact can be taken off the shelf when it's convenient, but then when it's inconvenient, you put it back. So a war criminal, and then a few hours later, send them more weapons.
Right. What's even the point? Like, what is the point of his doing that? Of making the point that he makes if he's just going to vote for it?
Well, you know, sometimes I think there's such a thin line between political analysis and psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, it's hard to know, but I would say that the atmosphere of support for Israel, quote unquote, support for the, quote, Jewish state, is so powerful that, to take an example more contemporary, more momentary, as we are in the last weeks of this presidential campaign, the polling is very clear nationally, as well as a YouGov poll in several of the swing states, that a substantial majority of the public, of voters, want an arms embargo on Israel. And one of the questions asked was, if you knew that the Democratic nominee supported an arms embargo, would you be more or less likely to vote for that person, to vote for Harris? And it isn't even close. More people would, they said, vote for Harris if she would come out for an arms embargo. And yet, you know, like Van Hollen turning around and voting for the weapons, Harris has been very clear that she has no intention of supporting an embargo on weapons to Israel as it keeps the ongoing daily massacre going on. So that's a sort of a political schizophrenia that we can chalk up to old school, you know, that Biden personifies, just fealty to the Israeli government, and also just plain cowardice, afraid of the pundits, more worried about what the Zionist pundits at the New York Times and Washington Post and those on MSNBC and the other cable news networks will say about you. And this is a really, you might say, ethically, morally, spiritually corrosive reality that does make wars invisible in a visceral sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to actually take a look at these double standards that we are talking about. And I think they're pretty evident just in the way you have Joe Biden responding to Israel and Kamala Harris responding to Iran. So let's compare these two responses. So we have, this is Biden's response to Israel's so-called limited incursion.
That Israel may be now launching a limited operation into Lebanon. Are you aware of that? Are you comfortable with their plans?
I'm more aware than you might know, and I'm comfortable with them stopping. We should have a ceasefire now. Thank you.
Do you expect Iran to retaliate?
Okay, so there we have it. Not the...
We have it. I mean, he, at first, Biden last fall and winter would not call for a ceasefire, but by early this year, he said he wanted a ceasefire, only it's more than a pretense of being a fly on the wall. It's preposterous that he calls for a ceasefire and keeps making a ceasefire impossible by shipping the weapons.
Of course, yeah. So let's compare that to this clip of Kamala Harris' response to Iran.
I'm clear-eyed. Iran is a destabilizing, dangerous force in the Middle East, and today's attack on Israel only further demonstrates that fact. Earlier today, I was in the Situation Room with President Biden and our national security team as we monitored the attack in real time and ensured that the protection of U.S. personnel in the region is paramount. I fully support President Biden's order for the U.S. military to shoot down Iranian missiles targeting Israel, just as we did in April. We are still assessing the impact, but initial indications are that Israel, with our assistance, was able to defeat this attack. Our joint defenses have been effective, and this operation and successful cooperation saved many innocent lives. As I have said, I will always ensure Israel has the ability to defend itself against Iran and Iran-backed terrorist militias. My commitment to the security of Israel is unwavering. And let us be clear, Iran is not only a threat to Israel, Iran is also a threat to American personnel in the region, American interests, and innocent civilians across the region who suffer at the hands of Iran-based and backed terrorist proxies. We will never hesitate to take whatever action is necessary to defend U.S. forces and interests against Iran and Iran-backed terrorists. And we will continue to work with our allies and partners to disrupt Iran's aggressive behavior and hold them accountable.
I mean, what do you think of these back-to-back responses?
Well, in terms of what Harris said, I like part of it. When she said it was really good to shoot down the missiles that were headed towards potentially civilian areas. Problem is that if the U.S. government wants to shoot down missiles that are aiming towards or could be aiming towards civilians, for the last 51 weeks, they should have been shooting down their own missiles. I mean, it's just a ridiculous contradiction that the Israeli government has been terrorizing, maiming, killing so many civilians in Gaza. And yet this is, and of course she was reading the script, the pretense is, we have this value system involved that we're trying to fulfill as though there's a consistent through line, when actually it's, I think there's a lot to recommend Marxism, but I think maybe even Lewis Carrollism is better from Through the Looking Glass, where Humpty Dumpty is asked by Alice, how can you make one word mean so many different things? And Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who has the power? That's all. And so we're seeing that played out again and again, the rhetoric. I think we heard Harris say, Israel has a right to defend itself. Well, Palestinians have a right to defend themselves, one would think. And I'm sure, Katie, and you've taken a lot of attacks for supporting Palestinian rights. I'm sure you have encountered this line thrown at you. I have as well. What are you talking about? Israel has a right to exist. And that's a very common phrase, that if you criticize what the apartheid system, the war system of the Israeli government, that you're told, hey, you're not respecting or supporting Israel's right to exist. And my response at this point is, did the apartheid South African government have a right to exist?
Right.
And does the apartheid Israeli government have a right to exist? And I would say no.
Right. And we had Craig McIver on the show who has talked about how Israel's right to self-defense is a double lie, because as he points out, Israel does not have the right to self-defense, to defend itself against the people it's occupying. Palestinians do have the right to defend themselves. Now, of course, as is important distinction, that means that you can take up arms against combatants, not against civilians. But it's also a double lie, because what Israel's doing is not actually self-defense anyway. So they neither have it, nor are they exercising it. One more double standard I wanted to show, and this is an article that's the great media critic Saul Rod tweeted out. Okay, so this is from AFP. Entire world should condemn unacceptable Iranian missile attack, Blinken. Iran's missile attack on Israel was, quote, totally unacceptable and should be condemned by the entire world, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Tuesday. And by the way, that's the same Secretary of State who lied to Congress about Israel cutting off humanitarian aid. And this is what Saul pointed out. Iran launched a retaliatory attack months after Israel carried out an assassination on Iranian soil and promises of a ceasefire failed with zero casualties. The U.S. is yet to condemn Israel's genocide because it's arming and funding it. Their hypocrisy is totally unacceptable.
Well, here's a guy, Secretary of State, who's been traveling the globe for several years now, talking about a rules-based order. And he also has talked about it must never be that one country is just allowed to cross a border and invade another country. I mean, there's a personal level, which he was the chief of staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 2002 when Biden wielded the gavel, and they had in the middle of the summer these bogus hearings that would not allow testimony from people who questioned the plans to invade Iraq. So they have a long history, and it's not a personal issue. They just happen to be those individuals, but it's structural. It goes on again and again. So when Blinken talks about a, quote, rules-based order, as I say, he really is saying in his policy, we make the rules and we can break the rules. And that is what is, if you're looking for a consistency in U.S. foreign policy, it is the consistency of that inconsistency.
Right. You write in your book related to rules-based order, verbiage about a rules-based order presents a nice pose of wanting international relations without military aggression. A related pretense is that the United States only engages in warfare when impelled by the deeds of bad actors. But obviously, behind the scenes, U.S. officials like will quietly back Israel's military push against Hezbollah. Can you tell us more about, as you describe, Biden's walk, talk without action, the way he talks the talk but doesn't walk the walk?
Yeah, the pose is reluctance to engage in military attacks or anything like that. And I think it's a very useful PR one. I think of something that the military strategist long ago, von Clausewitz, said, every conqueror is a lover of peace. And I think of that a lot when I hear Biden or Netanyahu talk, when they use the standard language about they really want peace. And of course, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon out of the White House said they wanted peace. So it's not a matter of a grain of salt. It's like a huge box of salt that would be necessary just to understand what they're really saying. It's a it's an attitude that says we can blow smoke as much as we want, and the public, U.S. public, after all, USA has elements of democracy. U.S. public won't catch up with us. That is the modus operandi.
Something that I was actually shocked got into the media at all was Leon Panetta's statement about, this seems like forever ago, an eternity ago, Leon Panetta's statement about the so-called pager attack. And I just wanted to take a look at this clip of him responding to it.
To be able to place an explosive in technology that is very prevalent these days. And turn it into a war of terror, really, a war of terror. This is something new.
Is it terrorism?
I don't think there's any question that it's a form of terrorism. This has gone right into the supply chain, right into the supply chain. And when you have terror going into the supply chain, it makes people ask the question, what the hell is next?
It sounds like you're genuinely worried.
I am. This is a tactic that has repercussions. And we really don't know what those repercussions are going to be. The forces of war are largely in control right now of what's going on.
Do you think there should be condemnation for it? Should other nations step in, including us?
I think it's going to be very important for the nations of the world to have a serious discussion about whether or not this isn't an area that everybody has to focus on, because if they don't try to deal with it now, mark my word, it is the battlefield of the future.
Well, I think this is sort of a paradigm that happens not often enough, but does happen. Leon Panetta, former CIA director, former Department of Defense, I put defense in quotes, uppercase D, he's 86 years old. He's near the end of his life, presumably. His career is certainly over in Washington. And for whatever reasons, he feels freed up or felt freed up in that interview Sunday show a week or so ago to speak honestly. Essentially, he was saying that Israel is a terrorist state. And that's almost forbidden in U.S. news media. And if he were not former Secretary of Defense, he might never be invited back. You know, he stepped over the line.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of stunning when you see someone like a former CIA director say something more radical than the mainstream media. I mean, no one in the media was calling this terrorist or suggesting it, really, except for this person kind of was. But I think that's an exception. Everyone was accepting the claim that this was a targeted surgical strike.
Yeah. And I had to remember when I saw that clip that you just played, that in 2016, as a Bernie Sanders delegate to the Democrat National Convention, I was one of hundreds of us who interrupted Leon Panetta's speech
right.
to the convention. We were chanting, "No more war." And he was shocked and certainly was, for lack of a better term, a warmonger at that time. So what do we have? We have 8 years later, he's speaking truthfully. And this is a paradigm when people occasionally are no longer in power. We need to force people in power to acknowledge such realities.
Right. This is just, this is from today. And this is Matt Lee, the intrepid journalist who actually asks good questions from the AP, asking State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller about Israel and Iran. So Matt Lee says, does the administration see anything that Israel has done over the course of the last 3 weeks as escalatory? And Matthew Miller responds, there is a difference between Israel's actions in Lebanon to defend its civilians and actions Iran took today against another state.
Yeah, these are standard responses that we get from people like Matt Miller in the State Department or Kirby, who actually is not mentioned much, but is a former admiral at
right.
the White House. And it's maddening. You know, when I was first working on this afterward for War Made Invisible, I was hoping that I was writing history about the war on Gaza, you know, so February, March, April. And I wasn't only writing history. The book is out in paperback and it's still going on. It's a war without end. And we might remember that endless war developed sort of a bad odor. It was something that presidents and candidates claimed they were going to stop, but it's been revived, and the sort of the camouflage of U.S. wars are now back out in the open.
Mm. Another question that I want to ask you is that you earlier on had referred to how Kamala, it would be politically popular and expedient for Kamala Harris to call for a ceasefire. And yet the fact that she's not doing that, does that mean that she doesn't believe the information? Does that mean that she's a true believer? Does that mean that she's ideologically supportive of Zionism? Does that mean that, and this is a question I often have, because John Mearsheimer says basically, and I think this is something some people on the left are afraid to say, he says, you know, you're in a Biden at this point, when we interviewed him, Biden was still going to be running. And it's like, he wasn't saying this from a moral, ethical perspective. He was saying this as a realist. He was saying that Biden was in a damned if you do, damned if you don't position, because if he supported Israel's war, he was going to lose a lot of popular support, a lot of support among the people who helped elect him last time. But if he didn't support it, he was going to be, you know, attacked by the lobby. How much of a political, what is the political cost-benefit analysis there? Like, in other words, maybe more people say that they would vote for Kamala Harris if she did the right thing. But could you argue that she would be politically kneecapped by the lobby, by donors?
I think she'd get a fierce amount of blowback from above, from very powerful forces, including the Israel lobby. In terms of what her calculus is internally, I think of something that the wonderful late Edward Herman told me and was saying to others when these questions came up. Of course, Ed Herman wrote with Noam Chomsky, Manufacturing Consent, and was a great media critic. And Ed said, there's no such thing as a sincerometer. Really, we don't know what the level or extent of sincerity is among any politician, or arguably anybody, but if we know them personally, we have a pretty good feel for it. But from afar, and by definition, politicians are constantly playing three or four dimensional chess to get ahead and all of that. So it's a sort of a long way of saying that we don't know. We can guess and reasonably assume certain factors. My hunch is that while Kamala Harris knows full well those polls, and I'm sure she does, for her, it's an unknowable. She'd be way out of her comfort zone. And Chaim Saban, you know, there's two words right there. When Joe Biden took a weeny, weeny step, I refer to in the book, he said, oh, we're not going to send 2,000-pound bombs right now. And Chaim Saban, who literally provided a large quantity of the millions of dollars that built the Democratic National Committee building in Washington, he went ballistic. And he said publicly that, you know, that was a really bad thing for Biden to do. And Saban, while he's been a huge funder of the Democratic National Committee and party, he also has given money to AIPAC and the Israel lobby, and essentially some of the election deniers he has given money to. So I think it boils down to that there's the known and the unknown. And the unknown must be pretty damn scary for Kamala Harris. Again, we don't know what's internal. From everything I have seen, it's a good hunch that she buys a Zionist view of the world.
Right. Well, Brad, why don't you come in? Because you're asking a question. This is actually a question Brad texted me. And I slightly disagree with his framing a little bit, because he just wrote to me, and I'll let him present it. But he said, does she not actually believe that Trump is an existential threat to the U.S., et cetera? If that were true, then you'd think she'd go with the embargo to get more votes. So, well, Brad, you want to come in and say that? I just read it. I just realized. But I guess the reason that I asked the question I just did right before is because I think that question skips a step, because you can say that according to a poll, you would get more votes. That doesn't mean, and I'm not, obviously I'm the last person to discourage her from doing the right thing, but this is why I asked you about the political cost of doing the right thing, right? If she would be kneecapped politically, because you can have a poll that says you'll get more votes. That doesn't mean that you'll
be handicapped
in another way. Yeah.
Okay. But if she was kneecapped politically, like if the lobbies or whatever were to go after her, then by extension, they would be supporting Trump. Right.
Well, there's no doubt.
Oh, you're saying, I see. Okay. I was missing your, yeah. They would be supporting Trump, right? By extension. Yeah.
Which would, according to them, is literal Satan and the greatest threat that this country has ever faced. And if that were true, I would think they would be doing everything in their power to make sure that that didn't happen.
No, you just contradicted yourself though, because here's what we're saying. If she ran on an embargo, right?
Yeah.
And that kneecap and that a lot made her popular among young people, right? Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. That's a plus. But my question, my devil's advocate / realized question was, would that make her politically weakened because the donor class would abandon her, AIPAC would go after her, and would that actually suppress the votes, right? And you just said they would go for Trump, who's Satan. And she would say, why I can't do the embargo, because if the donors undermine me, then Trump wins. In other words, for your question to work, we have to know that she would, that the popularity she would get from the embargo would outweigh the cost, political cost.
So were it not for those donors, Trump would win? I would think that were it not for votes, like, she needs to win what, like Michigan, maybe two other states. Like that's basically what it comes down to. And I'm just questioning, like, at this point, she really needs, I mean, she's gotten hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Like,
right. But isn't the way it works that, like, literally a donor I don't know, actually, this is a question I have, I guess, for Norman, but I was under the impression that it's not just about like the money you have. Donors could literally do something, or AIPAC could literally do something like try to get people confused about where the voting location was. In other words, it's not just about the money, right? Can't they actually sabotage you electorally?
Well, I don't know if they would do something that overt, but certainly messaging could be extremely powerful. I would say almost without hesitation that we can never know what Kamala Harris really believes, because that's an internal condition. But we can know about her behavior and where she gets her bulk of support and who she is adhering to in terms of the the political lines. And I think that's all we can really go on, is what she has done. And the fact that she will not call for an arms embargo tells us a lot about her. It doesn't tell us nearly anything, everything, certainly not everything about what kind of president she would be. I think it is notable that without any doubt, Benjamin Netanyahu wants Trump to be the next president.
Yeah.
And that tells us something. It's really hard to imagine a president being worse for Palestinian people than Joe Biden. And yet, if you read Rashid Khalidi's book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, he chronicles the presidency of Donald Trump, and he makes clear just what a disaster it was. It was a whole new level of support for Israel.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess there is that question, though, right? About like how donors would steal, like, could donors help Trump steal the election, let's say, steal the vote, like use a voter suppression?
Well, like Miriam Adelson and others, of course, are giving, you know, tremendous amounts of money to Trump-aligned efforts and PACs and so forth. It's hard to know, because we're going to be in a realm for the next 4 weeks of a lot of dirty tricks and lies. They're already out there, the incorrect information about polling places, and you know, it's going to be a free-for-all.
And I mean, my personal opinion is too, I could be wrong, but I don't think that I think that their description of Trump being like literally Cthulhu rising from the ocean or something, I don't believe that. I would believe more about the people that he surrounds himself with. I personally think that he's a complete joke of a clown.
He can't
be both an incompetent clown and like a James Bond villain mastermind. You have to pick one. But I also think that from like a political standpoint, the Democratic establishment is fine either way. Like if they win, okay, that's 4 more years and they're in power, that's cool. If they lose, that's 4 years that they can send you emails asking for money because they have to fight Trump and blah, 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 so that they can get in and codify Roe versus Wade, which then they won't, because if they do that, then they can't send you emails asking you for money to do that.
Well, for the consultant class, certainly there's a huge amount of money that's going to flow no matter what.
Right.
Jen O'Malley Dillon was the chair of the Unity Reform Commission when there was efforts to bring in or acknowledge the power of the Bernie forces after 2016 election. I went to a couple of those meetings, and it was clear that she was working very hard to block conflict of interest rules for the DNC. She made sure they didn't happen.
Right.
And then she goes on to the White House, and now she's running first the Biden and now the Harris campaign. So it goes to your point. That said, you know, and this is sort of to step back more on foreign policy, my own particular outlook is that it's really hard to know whether Trump or Harris, because of her coterie that we can discern, hard to know who would be better or worse. When it comes to domestic policy, there is no question. The right-wing forces that are aligned with surrounding Trump are the most repressive, toxic, fascistic in our lifetimes.
Like the Stephen Millers of the world, like that dude's essentially a Nazi, you know?
Yeah.
But how about this? Just a quick question. I don't know if, and correct me, please correct me if I'm wrong. I think that the Biden administration recently, if it hasn't already, it's going to happen very soon, basically reinstated the student loan debt collections with interest, et cetera, on them, which to me, doing that, you know, less than 60 days out from an election, the election, probably isn't doing you any favors. It's certainly not helping in that regard. What would be the political?
I haven't followed the ins and outs, but it's just been a catastrophe in terms of getting what needs to be done.
And so again, like it would just be another instance where I'm like, if you really thought that you losing this election would be like the end of quote unquote democracy or whatever, why would you do that then?
Well, look at this guy, how he has behaved. As president, especially in the last year. I mean, it's just, notable, just to get back to our, you know, our main topic here, he has turned Middle East policy over to his top aides, who are just bottom feeders. Yeah. They're really a hawkish, right-wing, in the Democratic Party context, militarists. You know, like I like to quote Martin Luther King Jr., the madness of militarism. They're unhinged, and he's basically letting them run the show. And there was an article in the last day that Politico published, made it very clear that the Biden administration green-lighted what Israel has been doing in the last few days in Lebanon. And so that's where paying attention to their rhetoric is really deceptive. These are very dangerous people. The Trump people are very dangerous as well in foreign policy. And it's a challenge for whether we call ourselves progressives, anti-war people, humanists. The label doesn't really matter. We need to confront the reality that the Israeli military, with one of the most powerful air forces in the world, is run by reckless people and are integrated into the, if not command structure, the overall geopolitical strategy of the U.S. military. And, you know, the Monroe Doctrine isn't enough for them. They want both hemispheres, and they are tilting towards a confrontation with China. It's almost taken as a given. I spoke to the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation annual conference in D.C. last week, and then they had a bunch of panelists who basically ignored what I said as the keynoter, and a lot of it was, how are we going to stop the threat from Russia? How are we going to stop the threat with China? And a lot of it focuses not on Taiwan, but on the South China Sea. And you could wait for 100 years, and I bet you they would not stop and think, why does the South China Sea have its middle name? Because they believe it should be an American sea.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Right. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time talking with me, Norman. I'll get out of here. Thank you.
I mean, Brad, just one more thing. I don't think that your thesis is wrong, that like that there are, that the Democrats care more about the consultancy class and fundraising than they do about defeating Trump. I mean, didn't we see like poll after poll that Bernie did better against Trump than Hillary did in 2016?
It's the same principle.
Same principle. I was just saying there is one step that I feel like we have to take, like to prove your point, which is because the way that our democracy works, it sadly doesn't mean that having more people say that they will vote for you will guarantee you the election, because you can buy, you can like do robocalls and tell people to go to the wrong location or whatever. So I think all things being equal, like we could definitely say, yes, this is proof. The fact that, like, if we knew that she would win the election by doing the right thing and she still didn't do it, that would be, you know, I'm just playing kind of devil's advocate, I guess. But
there's uncertainty. There was a really great article in the American Prospect a couple of days ago about just the myth of these polls being accurate. Mm. And historically, especially the presidential polls, they're often just plain wrong, even in on their own terms, the margin of error. So it's quite possible that the Trump and Biden campaign hierarchies, or I said Biden-Harris campaign hierarchies, they don't know. They don't know if they're going to win or not. And we certainly.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, I'll get out of here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Brad. This is great. But I just realized we got so carried away by this discussion that I wanted to ask you a final question for me, because you've been really generous with your time and we got to get to that debate and watch how terrible both parties are. Tell us about your article that you just wrote about the 1,000 Holocausts.
Yeah, it was actually adapted from the talk I mentioned that I gave to the conference in D.C. last week. And I was lucky enough to work a bit with Daniel Ellsberg. His book, The Doomsday Machine, is brilliant. It should be. As a matter of fact, at the Institute for Public Accuracy, we got 535 copies 5 years ago. And I and several other people, walked around the Capitol and hand-delivered them, each copy to each member of Congress. And Dan had written a personally signed letter, Dear Congressperson Smith, Dear Congresswoman Jones, whatever. And it explained why the book was especially focused on the need to shut down ICBMs. And so it's sort of a long discussion, but in a nutshell, ICBMs and there are 400 of them in five Western states in silos, they're the opposite of deterrence. They invite attacks because, unlike air-launched and sea-launched nuclear weapons, they can be vulnerable to an attack. So they're in the category of use them or lose them. So if there's a flock of geese or maybe the wrong drill tape inserted by some SATCOM or other official, as has happened, it can be a few minutes away from a nuclear war by, quote, accident. So shutting down ICBMs is really important. It's not on the media landscape, certainly not on the landscape or the agendas on Capitol Hill. And in Dan's book, he talked about, as a nuclear war planner, in 1961, he'd come into the Kennedy administration and he was handed a piece of paper. And it said that if the United States launched a nuclear attack on Russia, China, and Eastern Europe, there would be 600,000 deaths. And then I went on to say that that was 1961. And today, given the fact that from what we know about nuclear winter, there would only be, according to the research, maybe 1 or 2% of people who would survive on the whole planet, figure 8 billion people before the war. You do the math. So it's no longer 100 Holocausts, it's more than 1,000 Holocausts. And yet you listen to what people running for federal office from Congress, from the White House, from presidential campaigns, they don't mention this threat. It's right in front of us. And that's where it's crucial that we wake up the people who are our leaders, because everything we have to be proud of has come not from the top down, handed down. It's been demanded and forced by people from the bottom up. And when it comes to human survival and the threat of nuclear war, the last place we'll get sanity from is the White House, the State Department, and Congress. We're going to have to demand it, and we're going to have to organize. And I do want to say, as sort of the last comment here, that at rootsaction.org, we've just launched something called Teach-In Network. And people can go to teachinnetwork.org on the web. Sign up, we'll give you updates. At teachinnetwork.org, we already have a couple of dozen great speakers, and it's going to be a campaign around this country, not just before, but after the election. There's so much shutdown repression coming from college administrators to not protest, to not have encampments, even to not have forums. And so if you go to teachinnetwork.org and sign up, you can be part of pushing back against this repression, against the Palestinian rights movement and against the anti-militarism movement. We really need to build those efforts to create the changes that are essential.
Well, thank you so much for your wise words and wisdom. And we covered a lot of ground, as is often the case when we talk to you, because you've such a comprehensive analysis. So anything you want to say before you leave, or are we good?
I think we're good. I want to invite people to visit us at rootsaction.org and also at accuracy.org at the Institute for Public Accuracy. And an unsolicited plug, Katie, you're doing great work.
Thanks.
Weekly and every day, I know it's a lot of work. Your journalism should be supported.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And you can do that at patreon.com/the Katie Helper Show. Thank you so much. Yeah. And one thing I want to read, one comment that was related to what you said when you were talking about the right to exist. We didn't allow the Confederacy and ethno state to exist. Exploding phones, yours next because you speak out against apartheid state. Yeah. Scary. Well, thank you so much, Norman. And we'll see you again, I'm sure, because you're always a great guest to come on.
Hey, thanks a lot, Katie.
Thank you. Have a great night. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you, Sparky, for your super chat. Thank you, Sparky, for that. Thank you, Hans Standish, for joining from Australia. Thanks, Katie, watching here in Australia. Great journalism. Thank you. Let's see. Sparky, always great. Thank you, Carmen Benoit, for that. Thank you, Don Zuger. I don't know if Galen's dead. And thank you at your mom's. That's an awkward thing to say. And thank you, Tarana Amadi Parker. And thank you, Fantomas Fanta, for the clips. Thank you, Tyler, for the non-live clips. Thank you, Nathan, for the research. Thank you, Brad, for everything, including that extra interactive element that we had. And yeah, make sure you join us at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And we will see you next week. Thanks so much, everyone. Bye.